A Case for Grace. There are a few words that preachers and some of the rest of us bandy around, and we assume everyone knows what they mean, and we never stop to explain them. I think that grace is one of these words. This place, Holden, is referred to as a place of grace. And I must confess, as a layman, that I have been confused about this word, and there is some basis for this confusion. And part of the blame must be laid at the feet of St. Paul and many after him, because it's used in different ways. St. Paul really put grace into the big time. You just check the concordance, you'll find this out. There's little mention of it until you get to him. He made it a key word, and well he might. He wrote about it, spoke about it, prayed about it, and I think he also dreamt about it. And instead of saying hi or hello, he said grace to you. And that's a real mouthful, and it's a wonderful greeting when you really know what it means. If I asked some of you to define it tonight, I'd probably get a variety of answers. Some of you would say charm, air or bearing, goodwill. Some of you would say a delay granted, a period of grace. We used to say something to our children, see tired little eyes and a tired little face. It's time to go to sleep. You've had an hour's grace. You see, that's what we meant by that. Some of the children, and then the next line was something about birds, you know. The birds are in their nests, and I just wanted to throw that in. Some of the children would say, yeah, I know what grace is. That's what you say before meals. Those of you who have been studying St. Paul would say with Dr. Mitten that it's God's unmerited, free, spontaneous love for sinful man, revealed and made effective through Jesus Christ. This you should immediately recognize is at the very heart of the Christian gospel, and it's one of its most distinctive features. Some of you might also point out that there's also another definition, as a kind of inner power which God bestows on men and women, enabling them to be better, stronger, braver, kinder, and more loving than they could be on their own. A Catholic dictionary defines grace as a supernatural gift freely given by God, which enlightens the intellect and strengthens the will. Now that's about all the definitions I'm going to give you tonight. Some of you know that Lois works with the Spanish-American migrants, and she knows the language very well. And she says, you know, in Spanish, gracia, or however you say it, grace. And if you add just an S to it, what do you have? Gracias, you have thanks. And with grace must come thankfulness for this unspeakable gift. And then here's another very interesting part of it. Graciosa. Graciosa is graceful or beautiful, or a comic actor, or a clown, or lighthearted, you see? So I think this is a beautiful thing, that you have to have this spirit just manifest here as we sang in the Beanie Sing, you see? This lightheartedness and to sort of be, have this sparkle that Carol talks about. Grace can also be described as the secret of God's presence in our life. Jesus considered no legacy more precious and indispensable than his abiding presence with us in the Spirit. And words to prove it. For where there are two or three gathered together in my name, there I am in the midst of them. Or remember, I will be with you always to the end of the age. Or I will never leave you nor forsake you. Last September, In my discussion of mystery, I told you about four mysteries in Proverbs. I would like to add two more: the way of God with men, and how God's grace invades our life. For grace is a mystery. Paul Tournier has said people come to him for help in solving their problems. But no one, he says, knows better than himself that he or any person is powerless to solve any problem. In trying to understand the difficulties people tell him about, he discovers nothing but insoluble, vicious circles. Then you may well ask, why would anyone spend money by bringing problems to Dr. Tournier or any other psychiatrist who doesn't believe in a solution? The answer is easy. He doesn't believe in their solution, but he believes in their dissolution. He believes they can be dissolved by grace, like fog that disappears with the hot rays of the sun. That's what the Christian gospel of salvation does. It gradually dissolves tangled problems without solving them in the usual sense of the word. In the climate of faith, a life that seemed nothing but a tangle of problems is transformed. The problems disappear without any human actually solving them. And it all happens through the mystery, the miracle of God's grace. Grace dissolves problems without our ever knowing exactly how. Now, in preparing this, I thought that a parable was in order to tell about this mystery. I was first tempted to define and describe grace to you by reading Ezekiel 16. But then some of you who are not too familiar with Ezekiel 16 might think I have just obtained some obscene literature out of Copenhagen if I read it to you. So I have a modern parable, not unlike Ezekiel 16. Once there was a little orphan girl who grew up in miserable surroundings. Her foster parents really didn't want her, and they were hard and rough. As a baby and as a growing child, she was denied the intimacy, compassion, and concern of a true home. She had never been loved. As she grew into womanhood, discouragement, brutality, egotism hardened her heart. All she knew was daily bickering, and she soon learned she had to look after her own rights, for nobody, just nobody, did. She learned to live by the law of the jungle: bite before you're bitten. As long as she could remember, that's how it had been, and that's how it would always be. She'd had no faith in mankind. She didn't even have any faith in herself. Her whole appearance betrayed the presence of any remnant of self-respect. She dressed in cheap and graceless attire. Her one escape from boredom, from hopeless emptiness, was rough, ribald, and rowdy amusement. She was selfish, suspicious, and uncouth. Bitterness distorted her mouth. Aware that the way she dressed and acted, she had no beauty, and that all men wanted from her was her body for a few lustful moments. Living in this same town was a remarkable young man who had grown up in a home where love and affection of parents, brothers, and sisters were the order of the day. And this love was reflected in this young man's voice, in his manner, and in the gleam in his eye. He manifested the assurance of one who had found peace. He was what we'd call a good person, a real human being. And then a miracle occurred. It was spring when the young man chanced to meet this girl, and his heart went out to her. With the eyes of love, he saw right through and beyond her shabbiness and her vulgarity. He looked out for her. He spoke to her with simplicity and concern. But she just laughed in his face. She talked to him in crude terms, using unmannered language and an unjudicious sprinkling of four-lettered words. And I don't mean cook and wash. She thought he was ridiculous, And she told him so. But this young man's tact, patience, and his respect finally found their way into what little yearning still remained within the depths of this girl's being. For the first time in her life, she was appreciated for her own sake, the greatest need of every person. Yet the beauty that she now revealed came not from her, but from his love. Love, you see, has been the creative power since the beginning of time. The young man's love and attention and appreciation stirred in her self-reliance, a quiet self-assurance, and peace. Timidly, she awoke to first love. Shyly, she began taking more thought of her appearance, although it was gaudy still. But his tenderness and example refined her taste. Beauty came to her with the first real smile. The two of them soon became absorbed in one another. They became drawn together in selfless exchange of mutual love. At this point, you and I are moved to ask, what really happened here? What had happened is that this girl had been granted a great favor, a matchless gift. A gift she had not earned, the gift and favor of love, and that's grace. After a long, barren winter of youth, spring came into her life, and she was transformed. She was redeemed by the love of another. Her old self had died, and not easily. It was not without pain she discarded the distrust, the hatred, and the vindictiveness she had nursed herself on so long. She had resigned herself to being stripped bare of these, and a new life was born. Like a ship without a rudder on an angry sea, she tried another tack. She took on a rudder and set a course to an unknown destination. She made the leap of faith in another. And the marvel of it all, she found security in surrender. Faith and hope led to real love. The final leap that is indispensable to anyone who wants both to lose himself and find himself in another. The girl had lost everything on which she had relied, but she was rewarded superabundantly by grace. She quit putting her trust in appearance and superficiality. She now saw more deeply into things. She discovered beauty in the world around her, the setting sun, the purple shade, the light in the eyes of a child, the laughter in a voice. She now saw everything through the eyes of her beloved. She had become another being. She had become what God had really meant her to be. That's what grace can do for the likes of you and me. A beautiful yarn, you say? Just a story? Whatever view you take of this parable, one thing I am certain of, only a pure and powerful love can change bitterness and hatred into a love returned. And it is beyond man acting on his own to do this. That is why there had to appear a man like no other man, without sin, a man possessing God's heart. And when he came, the tale just told became true. One of the interesting characteristics of grace is its invasiveness. Now, it isn't difficult to learn the way most things work. If in doubt and all else fails, you can read the instructions. But how grace works is not so easily put into words. And that is why I'm going to tell you another story about the invasiveness of this. Dr. Reed called it intrusiveness, which is invasion without invitation. And one of the better examples, I think, of this, for illustrative purposes, took place at a well in Shechem. It was high noon on a hot day. An itinerant preacher named Jesus had been walking quite a long ways, and he was very thirsty. And on arriving into this town, he had sent his associates down to the local 7-Eleven to buy some groceries, and I suppose to save a little time. And so they went there to buy groceries and, I imagine, some Royal Crown Cola. And while he was waiting for his associates to return, he spotted a pretty good-looking chick with a pot on her head heading for the well. So he sauntered over and he said, "Give me a drink." Now, this sounds pretty simple and safe to most of you here, but it really wasn't. And this woman, who had really been around, recognized the threat immediately, and she shot back a question. "How come you, a Jew, ask a drink of me, a woman of Samaria?" She recognized she had nothing to gain and a lot to lose by getting involved with this thirsty Jew. Her privacy was being invaded. She'd give away water that wasn't that easy to draw. She'd lose some questionable pride, because in that day, unlike ours, women were held to be inferior rather than superior, as they're held now. And men didn't salute women. They didn't even salute their wives in public. So Jesus was doing a very irregular thing. And her patriotism was also being undermined, for since the exile, to be pro-Samaritan was to be anti-Jewish. And there were hard feelings between the Jews and the Samaritans, and these feelings were strong and they were deep. Her preconceived notions of a Jew were also being threatened. As you know, it's a very disturbing experience to have one's prejudice shaken and unsettled. We like our prejudice. We like them in neat array. This makes life manageable. It also saves us from having to take out time to think and to reason. I'd like to show a cartoon at this time, but I won't. I'll describe it to you. It shows this lady under an umbrella talking to another lady on Miami Beach. And she said, "All I know is that I stopped listening to reason and my headache was gone." Generalizations, you see, are so handy. Like, welfare recipients are lazy. Politicians are crooks. Indians are drunkards. Policemen are brutal. Liberals hate America. Conservatives don't want any change. The members of the ALC are prudes. The members of the LCR are the country club set. And those Missourians, they're the beer and pretzel gang. And you know, this is how we do it. These generalities are our refuge. But for this woman, and also for us, when Jesus comes our way, the neat pigeonholes begin to dissolve and run together. Our neatly constructed categories crumble. This woman's religious loyalty was also being threatened. For Jews regarded Samaritans, and especially Samaritan women, as unclean. They just didn't share the same drinking cup. And there he stands, with no cup but hers, no water bucket but hers. Now you think all this is bad, but it gets worse as the conversation continued. "If you know the gift of God," said Jesus, "and who it is that is saying to you, 'Give me a drink,' you would ask of him and he would have given you living water." "Sir," she replied, "give me this water that I may not thirst." But I'm not so sure at this point if she didn't think that he was pulling her leg. But then, realizing that grace is best shared, Jesus said, "Go call your husband and come here," which I must say was a very sneaky thing for Jesus to do, because he knew all about her. But this gal played it cool. She said, "I have no husband." To which Jesus said, "You're right on. You're correct. For you've had five husbands, but that guy you're shacking up with now isn't your husband." Wowee. That's a very disturbing person to have around, isn't it? He might ask you for a drink. And I'm sure at this point this woman said to herself, "All I did was to come out here for a bucket of water." "And all my secrets are no more." He knows that I can get husbands, but I can't keep them. He knows I'm already two over par. Because the legalist, you see, you're only allowed three, and that's all. She also figured out that he knew that she didn't lose her husbands by being widowed. No doubt she'd built up a rationale to justify her easy virtue. Because we have to live with ourselves, she had to learn to live around her past. But all this was now torn away. The subject she wanted least to talk about was the subject under discussion. Some of you who follow the theater may recall some years ago a play called The Rope Dancer. A young girl in that play had the misfortune of being born with six fingers on each hand. And all through the play, she went around with her hands in her pockets. And when someone threatened to take away her pockets, she screamed from the very depth of her being, "Don't take away my pockets. I can't live without my pockets." The Samaritan woman did what most of us do when an unpleasant subject comes up. You change it. "Sir, I perceive that you are a prophet. Our fathers worshipped on this mountain, and you say that in Jerusalem is the place where men ought to worship. We've all gotten very good at postponing or parrying the ultimate question with sophisticated and not so sophisticated questions on religion. Don't you think there are too many churches? Don't you think there are too many denominations? Don't you think that the King James Version is better than all these modern versions? Don't you think it is better to say trespasses than debts that Paul Fanning talks about?" And all this while God is saying, "Son, daughter, give me your heart." When she shifted from the place of worship, Jesus shifted to the manner of worship. And then she says, "I know the Messiah is coming. When he comes, he will show us all things." This is the ultimate of postponement. Let's just leave well enough alone until the Messiah comes. You see, it's much easier to live with a Messiah who is yet to come than one who is already here. Jesus stopped it all. "I who speak to you am he." That's invasive grace, the grace of God that we sing about so easily and talk about so glibly. It's a disturbing experience, this invasive grace, as it was to this woman. God cannot come as just an add-on. He is not an additive. He is an alternative to our weak and futile ways. The pockets have to be torn away so that you can see your hands in a completely new way. And this woman, for her, it was a transformation, not an additive. She hot-footed it back into town with a joy she'd never known before, shouting excitedly to everyone that would listen, "Come see a man who told me all that I ever did. Can this be the Christ?" And do you know what happened? John tells us what happened. Many Samaritans from that city believed in him because of that woman's testimony. So you better look out for thirsty people who ask you for a drink if you're afraid of invasive grace. Another example. It was a day in June when a friend of Al Rognes's called him on the phone, and he had a very sobering thing to tell him. He said, "I have just been to see my doctor, and he told me that I have cancer, and I may not live to see Christmas." He went on to tell Al, "I am not afraid to die, but I am afraid to meet God. And you've got to help me. You've got to tell me how he's going to deal with me." So Al told him that God was a God of mercy, and that this God, through Jesus Christ, forgives. And then he regards that forgiven person as if he'd never sinned. The man with cancer was shocked at this. This news shocked him because he was a lawyer, and this seemed utterly wrong. How could God treat a guilty person as if he were innocent? This is a miscarriage of justice. It would make mockery of law and destroy justice. He then said, I have never believed in purgatory, but I know he has to clean me up before he lets me in. The nail went on to talk about the mystery of the cross, and his friend became even more troubled. You see, it just didn't make sense to this attorney that God would assign the guilt of the human race on one righteous person. What kind of sense does that make? It's bad enough to let a guilty person off scot-free, but to transfer the sins to one who was without sin and let him take the penalty, that makes shambles out of everything. Not even a justice of peace court, or the lowest court in the land, would deal in such miscarriage of justice. That is what I believe St. Paul meant when he was talking about the offense of the gospel. The law, you see, is not offensive. Any decent person recognizes that the guilty should be punished and the innocent set free. In the gospel, we move completely out of the world of justice into the world of mercy and grace. And the cross of Jesus is that world. Before he died, this lawyer did enter into a strange new world, this world of the cross. And he was transformed. A radical transformation took place. And we rejoice over this. The strange ways of God with us are always like that. In a contract, it's always you do this and I will do that. But God says, you do nothing. I do it all. That's the way of radical love. That's grace. But don't get the notion that you're getting off scot-free, that this grace is cheap. Grace is free, but it isn't cheap. God could not possibly be a God of love if he was not also the final judge, and if he never bothered to hold us responsible. Having been found by God and finding myself as a son in his kingdom, and understanding in some small way the love that brought me there, there will be a thousand gentle but terrifying pressures to live like a son. I can no longer risk being what I was before, for I now want to know the excitement, the glory, the height and depth of God's love, and what it means to be a child of God, and thus to be a full human being, to be the person God meant me to be. And it was on a beautiful Friday of last week that the chief and I arrived at the Holden dock. And we were ushered into the bus, and as Keith carefully and skillfully piloted the bus up the switchbacks, I caught sight of a sign on the front of the bus. It read, "The ride up is free. The trip down is costly." And it hit me. That's grace. Grace is free, but it isn't cheap. The great unbounded love of God, undeserved by us, overwhelms us. That's the trip up, and it's grace. The trip down is our response to this unmerited grace, and it will cost us everything. It will cost us our life. But it's worth the trip. Amen.
I become very much emotionally involved in this thing I'm going to do to you tonight, because this particular thing was sent to me by a very good friend who I'd known since he was a very young boy. He was a very bright fellow, and he got sort of all mixed up, and he wrote me a very sad letter, and he included this thing. He sent me this, and it was about Lafcadio, the lion that shot back. And he signed his letter, Lafcadio. Several people have come up after I've done this and said, you know, I'm Lafcadio too. And this is real sad. This is about Lafcadio, the lion who shot back. It's by Shel Silverstein, who writes quite a bit. I should make right now that theology, theology is not a discipline in itself. It penetrates all disciplines. God penetrates everything. So theology isn't something over here, and theology is here tonight. It's an Uncle Shelby fable for children of all ages. Now, once upon a time, there was a young lion, and his name was, well, I don't really know what his name was, because he lived in the jungle with a lot of other lions. And if he did have a name, it certainly wasn't a name like Joe or Ernie or anything like that. No, it was more of a lion name, like, oh, maybe Gruff or Grug or Grump or Grr. Well, anyway, he had a name like that, and he lived in the jungle with the other lions, and he did the usual lion things like jumping and playing in the grass, swimming in the river, eating rabbits, chasing other lions, and sleeping in the sun, and he was very happy. Well, then one day, I believe it was Thursday, after all the lions had eaten a good lunch and were sleeping in the sun, snoring lion snores, and the sky was blue, and the birds were going caw, caw, and the grass was blowing in the breeze, and it was quiet and wonderful, and suddenly, blow! There was such a loud sound, all the lions woke up fast and jumped straight up in the air. And they started to run, lickety-split, clippity-clop, or clippity-clop, or clippity-clip. Or is that the way horses run? Well, they ran whatever way lions run. I don't know, maybe even pippity-pat. In a way, well, they ran away. Well, almost all. There was one lion that did not run. And that is the one that I'm going to tell you the story about. This one lion, he just sat up and blinked and winked in the sun, and he stretched out his arms. Well, maybe he stretched his paws, and he rubbed the sleep out of his eyes, and he said, hey, why is everybody running? And an old lion who was running by said, run, kid, run, 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 run. The hunters are coming. Hunters? Hunters? What are hunters? Said the young lion, still blinking in the sun. Look, said the old lion, you'd better stop asking so many questions and just run if you know what's good for you. So the young lion got up, and he stretched, and he began to run with the other lions, pippity-pat, or was it clippity-clop? I think we've all gone through that before. And after he had run for a while, he stopped and looked back. Hunters, he said to himself, I wonder what hunters are. And he said the name hunters over and over to himself. Hunters, hunters. And you know, he liked the sound of the name hunters. You know, the way some people like the sound of words like Tuscaloosa, or tapioca, or gumbo. He just liked the sound of hunters. So he let all the other lions run ahead, and he stopped, and he hid in the tall grass, and soon he could see the hunters coming, and they all stood on their hind feet, and they all wore nice little red caps, and they all carried funny sticks that made loud noises. And the young lion liked their looks. Yes, he just liked their looks. So when a nice hunter with green eyes and one tooth missing in front passed by in the tall grass with his funny red cap, that had some egg salad on it, by the way, and the young lion stood up. Hi, hunter, he said. Good heavens, cried the hunter. A ferocious lion, a dangerous lion, a roaring, bloodthirsty, man-eating lion. I am not a man-eating lion, said the young lion. I eat rabbits and blackberries. No excuses, said the hunter. I'm going to shoot you. But I give up, said the young lion. I hope. But I give up, said the young lion, and he put his paws up in the air. Don't be silly, said the hunter. Whoever heard of a lion giving up? Lions don't give up. Lions fight to the end. Lions eat up hunters. So I must shoot you now and make you into a nice rug and put you in front of my fireplace, and on cold evenings I will sit on you and toast marshmallows. Well, my goodness, you don't have to shoot me, said the young lion. I will gladly be your rug, and I will lie in front of your fireplace, and I won't move a muscle, and you can sit on me and toast all the marshmallows you want. I love marshmallows, said the young lion. You what? Said the hunter. Well, said the young lion, to be absolutely honest with you, I don't know if I really love marshmallows or not, because I've never tasted one. But I love most things, and I love the sound of the word marshmallow. And if they taste like they sound, I just know I will love them. That's ridiculous, said the hunter. I have never heard of a lion giving up. I have never heard of a lion eating marshmallows. And I'm going to shoot you now, and that is that. And he put up his funny stick to his shoulder. But why? Said the young lion. Because I am, that's why, said the hunter. And he pulled the trigger, and the stick went click. What was that click, said the young lion? Am I shot? Well, as you can imagine, the hunter was very embarrassed about this, and his face turned as red as his cap. I'm afraid I forgot to load my gun, he said. I guess the joke is on me, ha ha, but if you will just excuse me for a moment, I'll put a bullet in, and we will go on from there. No, said the young lion, I don't think I will. I don't think I will let you put a bullet in. I don't think that I will let you shoot me. I don't think that I want to be your rug, and I don't think that you are a very nice hunter after all, and I think I'm going to eat you up. But why, said the hunter, because I am, that's why, said the young lion, and he did. And after he'd eaten the hunter up, he ate the hunter's cap, but it tasted sort of woolly. And after he'd eaten up the red cap, pooh, doesn't it make your mouth feel funny to think about eating a red cap? He tried to eat up the funny stick and the bullets, but he couldn't chew them, so he said, well, I guess I will keep these as a souvenir. And he picked them up in his teeth, and he carried them back to the other lions. Now, the other lions were all sitting around telling stories about who was the fastest in running away from the hunters and who was the bravest and who was the fiercest and the other lies like that that lions like to lie about. And when the young lion walked up to them carrying the funny stick, they all jumped up and said, yow-wee and yee, yow and wow, and where did you get that gun? 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 What is a gun? Asked the young lion. That is the stick they shoot us with, said the old lion. Now take it out of here and throw it away. It gives me goosebumps just to look at it. So the young lion sadly walked away with the gun in his teeth. I wonder, said the young lion to himself, I wonder how they shoot this thing in a way. So he picked up a bullet in his teeth and he pushed it into the gun with his nose and he shoved it into the barrel with his tongue. Then he stuck his left tooth into the trigger and tried to shoot it, but he couldn't. Then he stuck his right tooth into the trigger and tried to shoot it, but he couldn't. Then he tried to pick it up with his paws and shoot it with his claws, which was even sillier. And he tried to shoot it with his whiskers, and all he got out of that was tired whiskers. And he stuck his tail into the trigger and he pulled as hard as he could and the gun went baroom. And all the other lions jumped up in the air and started to run away. Hey, said the young lion, stop running. It's only me and I've shot the gun. Well, I can tell you that when the other lions found out it was only the young lion making all that noise, they were very angry. You had better forget about shooting, they said, and stick to lioning where you belong. But the young lion was very happy about shooting the gun. And you know what he started to do? Well, every afternoon, while the other lions were sleeping, he would sneak away over the mountain. He would practice and practice and practice for hours and hours until finally one day he was able to lift up the gun in his paws. And he practiced for days and days until finally he was able to shoot the gun. But of course, he wasn't able to hit anything except the sky. And so he practiced for weeks and weeks until he was finally able to hit the big mountain. And practiced for months and months until he was able to shoot the waterfall. And soon he was able to shoot the cliff. And soon he was able to shoot the trees, and soon the coconuts off the trees, and then the berries off the bush, and then the flies off the berries, and then the ears off the flies, and then the dust off the ears, and finally, the sunlight off the dust. Now, do you think he was a good shot? Well, just the best shot in the world, that's all, just the best shot in the whole world. And what did he do for ammunition? Why, every time he ran out of bullets, he just went out and ate up another hunter. Took his bullets and went back and practiced some more. He quit eating red hats, you see. And then one nice day he was practicing. The young lion heard some shooting from the other side of the jungle, and I don't have to tell you what happened. All the lions started running again. Where are you running? Asked the young lion. Look, said the old lion. We have gone through all this before. You had just better stop asking so many questions and move. So the young lion moved.
But after he'd been running for a while, he stopped and he said to himself, "Hey, why am I running away?" And he sat down right there in the middle of the jungle and began to shoot back at the hunters. Boom, boom. And suddenly, guess what? There were no more hunters left. And after a while, all the other lions came crawling out of their hiding places, and they couldn't believe their eyes, and they said, "Hey, what's going on around here anyway? And hey, what's happening? And golly gee," and stuff like that. And they were all surprised and happy, and they all had lunch. And then they lay down and slept in the sun with smiles on their faces and little bits of red wool on their whiskers. And the young lion, why, he was the happiest of all because he had piles and piles of new ammunition. And all the other lions said that he was the greatest lion that they'd ever seen. And they had seen plenty of lions. So all the lions lived a very happy life. They slept all afternoon, played in the sun, floated in the river, and had a good time. Never worried about anything, because every time hunters came to shoot, why, that young lion shot right back at them. Boom, bomb, bim, bam, until there were no more hunters left. And when men came into the jungle to find out what happened to the hunters, bim, bam, boom, pretty soon there weren't any more of the finder-outers left. And when men came to find out about the finder-outers, boom, bam, bim, pretty soon there weren't any more of the finder-outers about the finder-outers left. And pretty soon, no men came into the jungle at all. And it was nice and quiet. And all the lions were fat and happy. And all of them had nice hunter rugs. But then one rainy afternoon, while a young lion was practicing some very fancy shooting, like shooting with his teeth and his toenails and his elbows with one eye closed behind his back and sideways and upside down, a little fat, bald-headed man came walking through the jungle, and he had on a tall, funny hat and an elegant vest and a gold watch with a golden chain, shiny shoes, and he had a droopy mustache and a big, fat belly that shook when he laughed like a bowl full of raspberry jam. And he carried a gold-headed cane, and you could see that he wasn't used to walking through the jungle because he kept getting caught in the branches of the trees, and he kept tripping over roots, and he kept stepping in puddles, and he kept saying, "Oh, me, oh, my, and oh, we, and hey, it isn't hot, and darn mosquitoes, and hot chew," and stuff like that. Well, now the lions didn't hear him coming until the very last minute, because lions have very good ears, and they can hear things from far off, if their ears are washed, that is. But if their ears aren't washed, they can't hear much better than you can. And to tell the truth, I don't think lions wash their ears very often, because wash rags are very hard to get in the jungle. And soap costs 10 cents, and most lions don't have 10 cents. And even if they did, they couldn't buy a bar of soap, because who would sell a bar of soap to a lion? If a lion came knocking at your door and had 10 cents in his paw and said, "May I buy a bar of soap?" would you sell him a bar of soap? Well, so you can see why these lions didn't hear too well. But they saw him coming. And I'll tell you one thing, lions' eyes are always very good, and they can see very well in the dark. And it happened to be in the middle of the afternoon anyway. And lions see extra special well in the middle of the afternoon. And you never see a lion wearing glasses, do you? When the lion saw the little man coming, they didn't even bother to run. They just called out to the young lion, "Hey, dinner is here." And then they rolled over and went back to sleep. And the young lion, he just yawned and picked up his gun. "I think I will shoot this one standing on my head with one eye crossed and three paws tied behind my back," he said, as he aimed his gun. "Wait a minute, don't shoot me," cried the man. And the young lion said, "Why not?" And the man said, "Because I am not a hunter. I am a circus man, and I want you to come and be in my circus." "Circus, schmirkus, dominurcus," said the young lion. "I do not want to be in a cage in your old circus." "You wouldn't have to be in the cage," shouted the circus man. "You can be my trick shooter." "Shooter, schmooter, scooter, booter," said the young lion. "I am already a great shooter. I am the greatest shooter in the jungle." And he aimed his gun again. "But you can make lots of money. You can be the greatest shooter in the world, and you can be famous and eat wonderful foods and wear silk shirts and yellow shoes, smoke 50-cent cigars and go to wonderful parties and have everyone pat you on your back or scratch you behind the ears or whatever people do to lions. I don't know." "Ears, shears, a glass of beer," said the young lion. "What do I want with all that stuff?" "Everyone wants that stuff," said the circus man. "Come with me and be rich and famous and happy and be the greatest lion in the world." "Well," said the young lion, "if I do come, will I get a marshmallow?" A marshmallow, said the circus man, waving his gold-headed cane and twirling the golden watch and golden chain. A marshmallow? Why, my good fellow, you will have thousands of marshmallows. You will have marshmallows for breakfast, marshmallows for lunch, marshmallows for supper. And do you know what you will have between meals? Marshmallows, asked the young lion. Marshmallows, shouted the circus man, and I will build you a marshmallow house. I will get you a marshmallow mattress for your bed for midnight snacks. I will make you a marshmallow suit with a marshmallow hat. And when you take a shower, you will take a shower with hot, melting marshmallows. Why, you will have more marshmallows than any lion in the world. Shall I sing you the marshmallow song? Marshmallows, marshmallows, marshing, marshing, mellow, mellow, mellows, marshing, fellows, marshing. I'd rather you didn't, said the young lion. Well, it's really not a bad song, said the circus man, considering that I made it up. Well, anyway, pick up your gun, pack your suitcase, and let's go to the big city. I don't have a suitcase, said the young lion. Too bad you aren't an elephant, said the circus man, because then you could pack up your trunk. Ha, ha, ha. That's a pretty corny joke, said the young lion, even for the jungle. Snorted the circus man. Okay, pack up your toothbrush and let's get out of here. I don't have a toothbrush, said the young lion. No toothbrush, said the circus man. How do you brush your teeth? I don't brush my teeth, said the young lion. You don't brush your teeth, said the circus man. What does your dentist say about that? I don't have a dentist, said the young lion. You don't have a dentist, said the circus man. Well, then who? Look, said the young lion, if you want me to go, I will go. I will do anything rather than listen to all your terrible jokes. So the circus man got on the lion's back, and they marched out of the jungle. You are sure about those marshmallows, said the young lion. Absolutely sure, said the circus man, and away they went. Well, finally, after traveling for many days and nights, they came to the city, and oh, it wasn't anything like at all like the jungle. There were lots of people and tall square things and things that looked like hippopotamus that moved very fast with people inside of them. And the young lion was very confused. Can I have a marshmallow now, he asked. All in good time, said the circus man. Right now there are bigger things in store for Lafcadio the Great, star of Finchfinger's Circus. Who is Finchfinger? Asked the young lion. That is I, said the circus man. And who is Lafcadio the Great? Asked the young lion. That is you, said the circus man. But my name is Grump or Mump or something like that, said the young lion. Don't be silly, said the circus man. You can't say Grump the Great or Mump the Great or something like that great. From now on, your name is Lafcadio. And let me tell you, Lafcadio the Great, that things are really going to start popping for you. Well, let me tell you, old Finchfinger wasn't just kidding. That very morning, there was a great big parade for Lafcadio the Great all the way to the circus tent. The band was playing and the sun was shining and Lafcadio the Great was riding in a big golden convertible. The band was playing oompa, 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 and the people were cheering hurrah, hurrah, and yay, hey, hooray, and whoopee, and wow, and zowie, look at a lion, which means zowie, look at the lion. And they threw confetti at Lafcadio, who was so happy that he smiled at everybody and opened his mouth and caught some of the confetti and he ate it, and everybody cheered and he waved his tail all around and curled his mustache and honked the horn on the car. Honk, honk, and the band played oompa, oompa, boom, boom, up, up, oompa, oompa, and the crowd kept yelling, yay, hey, hooray! And Lafcadio the Great was the happiest lion in all the world. And finally, the ringmaster with a long mustache hollered, ladies and gentlemen, presenting the only sharp-shooting lion in the world, Lafcadio the Great. And everyone went hooray, hooray, and Lafcadio the Great came out. And he was wearing a brand new white suit that Mr. Finchfinger had bought for him. A big yellow cowboy hat, yellow boots, and he had a brand new silver gun with a pearl handler and a diamond-studded holster with lots of bullets made of pure gold. And he waved and he picked up his gun and he first shot 6 bottles off the table. Bang, 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 bang. And then he shot 100 balloons off the ceiling. Bang, 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 bang. You can put in the other 92 bangs yourself. And then he told everybody in the circus to put a marshmallow on his head, and he shot the marshmallows off everybody's head in the circus, including all the kids and a few of the monkeys. And then he told everybody in the audience to hold up the ace of spades. And he shot every card in the middle, 12,322 of them. But he did it with 12,323 shots because he missed one. And the people went, hurrah, hurrah, hurrah. And then he shot between his legs, and he shot under his arms, and standing on his head. He shot lying on his side and sitting on his hands, and he shot rolling over. And he never missed once after that. And the people began to shout, rah, rah, rah. Lafcadio the Great is the greatest shot in the world. And he was. And that was how Lafcadio the Great joined the circus. And from that day on, Lafcadio the Great was busy traveling with the circus from city to city, from New York to Racine to St. Paul, doing trick shots for millions of kids and men and women. And Lafcadio the Great finally tasted his first marshmallow, and it was delicious. And he had all the marshmallows he wanted. raw marshmallows, toasted marshmallows, southern fried marshmallows, marshmallows au gratin, scrambled marshmallows, poached marshmallows, marshmalloup, which is marshmallow soup, marshmallops, which are marshmallow chops, marshmallow, which is marshmallow stew, marshmallow-omelet, which is a marshmallow omelet, and marshma-everything. And of course, Lafcadio learned many things he had never learned before. He learned to sign autographs because he was so famous that everybody wanted his autograph. And everyone was especially delighted with him because he could sign six autographs at once. Two with his front paws, two with his back paws, one with his tail, and one with his teeth. But after a while, of course, he would sign only one at a time with his right front paw, because that was more like a man and less like a lion. And Lafcadio was becoming more and more like a man all the time. For instance, he stood on his back paw, and he learned to sit at the table with his left hand in his lap and his elbows off the table. And he had his hair cut and his mustache trimmed and his claws manicured. Oh, and he stopped eating menus, and he learned to wear dark suits and white shirts with button-down collars and tweedy brown suits with plaid shirts and turned-up collars. And he learned to wear collars with starch in them. And then he learned to wear collars with no starch in them. And he kept his tail curled up and seldom let it hang down except when he forgot himself or he had a little too much buttermilk to drink. And often he would be seen dancing in nightclubs with the most beautiful, beautiful girls. And as time went by, Lafcadio the Great became greater and greater. And his picture was in all the newspapers. And he became more and more like a man. He began to play golf, began to play tennis. He went swimming and diving. He began to paint pictures. But to tell you the truth, he couldn't draw a straight lion. And he did exercises to stay in shape. And he went skating. And he almost learned to ride a bicycle. And he spent vacations lying on the beach at Miami. And he learned to sing and play the guitar. And he learned to bowl. And he seldom said grrr, except on very special occasions. And everybody wanted him at parties. And he became a social lion. And he wrote his autobiography. And everybody bought it. And he became a literary lion. And he had his clothes made to order just so. And he became a clothes lion. And if you ever called him on the phone, the operator would tell you, "Sorry, the lion is busy." And I suppose he was just about as happy and rich and famous as anyone could ever hope to be. And then one day, Finchfinger the circus man came to visit him in his beautiful new mansion made of silver and gold and marshmallows. And he found Lafcadio the Great sitting in his living room, and he was crying. "Why are you crying, my friend?" Finchfinger asked. "You have money, and you are famous, and you have seven big cars, and you are loved by everyone, and you are the greatest shot in all the world. Why are you crying? You have everything." "Everything isn't everything," said Lafcadio, with great, the dripping big tears down on the golden rug. "I'm tired of my money and my fancy clothes. I'm tired of eating rock Cornish hen stuffed with rice. I'm tired of going to parties and dancing the cha-cha and drinking buttermilk. And I'm tired of smoking $5 cigars and playing tennis. And I'm tired of signing autographs. And I'm tired of everything. I want to do something new," he said. "But there isn't anything new to do." And he started to cry again. "Have you tried a few more marshmallows?" asked Finchfinger. "So far today, I've eaten 23,241,562 marshmallows," said the lion. "And I'm tired of them, too. I want something new." And he put his head down and he began to cry some more. "Now, now," said Finchfinger, "stop this crying. You know every cloud must have a silver lining. And I have just thought of a wonderful thing to do, and it's brand new." "What's that?" Bafcotti, the great, sniffed, looking up with great big tears running down his nose. Hunting, said the circus man. You can go to Africa on a hunting trip. Wonderful, said Lafcadio the Great. I have never been on a hunting trip. And Lafcadio the Great packed up his suitcase and his guns, and he and lots of the other hunters went to Africa to do a little hunting. And when they got to Africa, they put on their red caps. And they picked up their guns, and they went out into the jungle. And they all began shooting at some lions, when suddenly one very, very old lion looked closely at Lafcadio and said, Hey, wait a minute. Don't I know you? I don't think so, said Lafcadio. Well, how come you are shooting at us? Asked the old, old lion. Because you are a lion and I am a hunter, said Lafcadio. That's why. You are not a hunter, said the old lion, looking at him closer. You are a lion. I can see your tail sticking out from under your jacket. You are definitely a lion. Dear me, said Lafcadio. Dear me, so I am. I had almost completely forgotten about it. What is going on there, Lafcadio, said the hunter. Stop talking to those lions and start shooting those lions. Don't listen to him, said the old lion. You are a lion just like us. Help us, and after we finish with these hunters, we'll go back into the jungle and sleep in the sun, swim in the river and play in the tall grass, chase our tails and eat some nice raw rabbits and have a wonderful time. Raw rabbits, said Lafcadio. Oh, no. Don't listen to him, said the hunters. You are a man just like us. Help us, and after we finish with these lions, we'll sail back to America and go to some wonderful parties and play badminton and drink buttermilk and have a wonderful time. Buttermilk, said Lafcadio. Oh, no. Well, said the man, if you are a man, you had better help us shoot these lions, because if you are a lion, we are certainly going to shoot you. Well, said the old lion, if you are a lion, you had better help us eat up those men, because if you are a man, we are certainly going to eat you up. So make up your mind, Grump. Make up your mind, Lafcadio, said the man. Make up your mind, they all said together. And poor Lafcadio the Great, he couldn't make up his mind. He wasn't really a lion anymore, and he certainly wasn't a man. Poor, poor Lafcadio. What do you do when you don't want to be a hunter and you don't want to be a lion? Look, he said, I don't want to shoot any lions, and I certainly don't want to eat any of you hunters. I don't want to stay here in the jungle and eat raw rabbits. And I certainly don't want to go back to the city and drink buttermilk. I don't want to chase my tail, but I don't want to play badminton either. I guess I don't belong in the hunter's world, and I guess I don't belong in the lion's world. I guess I just don't belong anywhere, he said. And with that, he shook his head, and he put down his gun, and he picked up his hat. He sniffed a couple of times, and he walked away over the hill, away from the hunters, and away from the lions. And he walked and he walked. And soon from afar away he could hear the sound of the hunters shooting the lions. And he could hear the sound of the lions eating up the hunters. And he didn't really know where he was going. But he did know he was going somewhere. Because you really have to go somewhere, don't you? And the sun was just beginning to go down behind the hill, and it was getting a little chilly in the jungle, and a warm rain was beginning to fall, and Lafcadio the Great walked down into the valley alone.